720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. It is not super warm out there, but it's sunshiny and beautiful. So I hope you're able to enjoy some of that sunshine wherever you are listening from. Lots to do on the show today. We're going to be talking about all kinds of things, including how the office Christmas party is changing a little bit right now because of this very interesting time we're in office culture. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the program. But right now, we have been talking with, all about this ongoing work that ProPublica has been doing around healthcare, particularly around waste and healthcare. Really, really important work. I encourage you to visit ProPublica.org and look at this series because it is really, really fascinating. But we're joined now by Marshall Allen, who's a reporter there at ProPublica, who has been doing much of this ongoing work that is so, so fascinating. But this story in particular is really, really interesting. Your latest, all about how a hospital charged nearly $1,900 to pierce a five-year-old's ears. And this is yet another example of just this unbelievable cost. I think last time you were with us, we were talking about prescriptions and drug companies kind of giving us more than we need. But this is a whole new level when we're talking about pierced ears.
Hi, Amy. This story definitely brings things to the level of the absurd. Obviously, hospitals are not going around doing ear piercings very often, but I got contacted by a mom in Colorado who had said that when her five-year-old daughter went in for an outpatient procedure, the surgeon offered to do a little add-on ear piercing while her daughter was under. And the mom agreed, thinking that it would be free. I mean, she didn't plan on having the ears pierced at the hospital. So she went ahead and had it done. And then there was a operating room fee of $1,877 added on to the bill. And the insurance company, of course, rejected it. And so then the hospital came after the mom to pay for the ear piercing. And I think the thing that's crazy about it, it's not just that they charged it, because you could make a mistake and you could see how a mistake could be made where they would accidentally charge this amount of money to pierce a little girl's ears. But the really crazy thing is that the mom tried for months to get the hospital to waive this bill, and they dug in even deeper. They threatened to send the mom to collections and would not negotiate the bill at all. It wasn't until after I started calling the hospital — this was Children's Hospital of Colorado, by the way, so it's a very well-known hospital there in Denver. After I started calling the hospital, then they went ahead and waived the bill, which, you know, so by the time the story came out, of course, the bill had been waived. It was definitely an outrageous example of unnecessary treatment in a hospital, and also just the high prices charged by healthcare.
Right, right. Well, again, like I said at the top of this conversation, there's so much interesting work that ProPublica has been doing in this series all about waste and healthcare. And that last time you visited with us, that story really stuck with me, particularly about eye drops, of just how much is there. But this is really everywhere. I mean, although this ear piercing is kind of a, as you said, very kind of an absurd level of something we're seeing on a medical bill, this is happening in other areas too. Also in the piece, mentions about mammography and breast health, of other, you know, charges that are appearing on bills, even when it's things we don't believe we want or need that seem extra to a procedure.
Right. So in this case, Amy, I looked at a woman named Christina Arenas. She's a Washington, D.C. attorney. And she had contacted me because she had some unnecessary imaging done to diagnose her breast cysts. And cysts are like fluid-filled sacs that a lot of women, especially when they're younger, in their 30s or 40s, get in their breasts. And they can be treated different ways. If you go to your gynecologist's office, they might just, especially if it's a large enough cyst, they might just take out a needle and drain the cyst right there in the office. That would be sort of the least expensive and easiest way to deal with a cyst. And, you know, if the fluid is clear, then they know it's not cancerous and they know it's not a risk. And that's a pretty simple way to do it. Well, Christina didn't know that that was even an option, and she ended up getting sent to a radiologist's office where they did a mammogram, then they did an ultrasound, and then they did two ultrasounds to try and aspirate it and guide the needle to drain the cyst. So she ended up getting four imaging tests when she could have had none in this case, because it did turn out to be a non-cancerous cyst.
And so in these situations, I mean, as you note in the story, she didn't feel like she had a lot of leverage just kind of sitting there in a hospital gown made out of paper.
Right.
And in these situations, you know, across the range of things that we've looked at so far in this work that's happening at ProPublica around waste and healthcare, what leverage does the consumer really have? I mean, it's sometimes very scary when you're, you know, you've been told, you have this situation and this is what needs to be done. Sometimes it's hard to, I mean, even know better than the doctor and say, well, do I really need that? And how do I know I need that? How do we go in as informed consumers when sometimes we're in very vulnerable states when we're there with our doctors?
Well, first of all, you have to acknowledge, just like you said, a patient is in an extremely vulnerable state in most situations. But one thing you can do if you have an opportunity to do it is ask if the procedure is absolutely necessary. You know, you can ask, what would happen if I didn't do this procedure right now? Or what would happen? Are there any less invasive or less expensive ways to treat this problem that might be options for me instead of this thing that you're proposing that we do? And on the back end, you know, you can always ask for an itemized bill. There are a lot of times where there are errors in bills and things that get charged as add-ons, and consumers can look at the bill and ask for the cost to be justified and then demand that it be removed if it's not something that was necessary or not something that was actually done. And finally, there are a lot of payment assistance plans that a lot of people will qualify for. So even if you do get hit with a bill that's outrageous and unnecessary, those could be negotiated down by anywhere from 20 to 70%, depending on what the bill is. And, you know, it's a case where you can negotiate it. And so I definitely encourage people to try and negotiate.
Well, and that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about is it seems like the people that you spoke to in this piece all were threatened with collections. And sometimes it is a long and contentious process. If you do want to contest something on a bill, how do you protect yourself and your credit score during that process?
Well, so, you know, the consumers are in a really difficult position here because once the treatment is provided, they are going to hold you responsible for it. And it's a battle. And so in some states, I think that I've been told, so I'm not sure of this, you'd have to check this, but I am told that if you're disputing a bill and in the process of disputing a bill, it can't be used to be a mark on your credit. But that is a real risk with this situation. And this is why we need to be asking these providers to give us the prices up front to make sure that everything is transparent and that we're only getting the care that we actually need and not some type of add-on that's more expensive.
Right, right. I mean, that's key. I'm personally moved by this. One time I thought I broke my ankle, right? And I went and got an x-ray and they offered me a very heavy painkiller prescription. I said, I really don't want to take anything. It's okay if it hurts a couple days. I'm going to live. It's okay. And so this nurse said to me, do you want a couple Advils for the road? I said, oh, that'd be great. What I didn't say is how much is that Advil? I thought I was doing the right thing by turning down the prescription. And I got charged, I think, $300 for two Advils.
No kidding. That's outrageous. But that's the perfect example, right? I mean, you could have gone down to your drugstore and gotten Advil. You could have had a whole bottle for $4 or $5.
Right. And I didn't think
and
to ask.
That's just kind of just proves the point. They can charge really whatever they want for the services they provide. And there's really no accountability. And so there are some legislative changes that could be put into place. I mean, if our lawmakers decided to, they could put restrictions on prices. They could put restrictions on price inflation. There are things that have been done to eliminate things like sometimes they'll call it a surprise medical bill. If you get treated by a provider that's not in network, a lot of states are not allowing those things to happen now. So there are also legislative changes that can be made. And this is something where our elected officials need to start taking action on behalf of consumers instead of just looking out for what's in the best interest of the industry.
Yeah, indeed. Well, really important work that you're doing there at ProPublica. Thank you so much. We're going to continue to follow along with this series all about waste in healthcare. Thank you so much, Marshall Allen,
Amy,
for being with us. Have a good one. All right, we're going to take a break back in just a bit here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Hope you're enjoying some of that sunshine. Maybe a little chilly outside, but the sun is beautiful, and I hope you are soaking it in. So, still lots to do here on the program today. Lots and lots of things to discuss, including a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk about how a lot of companies are changing how they are approaching holiday parties this year in response to the wave of sexual harassment and assault allegations that are going on in industries around the country. So, we're going to be talking about that a little bit later. But joining us now is Nareda Moreno, who's a reporter at Chicago Tribune, who wrote about what's happened since Chicago raised the minimum wage 2 years ago and why some still are earning less than minimum wage. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. So talk us through this a bit, because it seemed like once this was put in motion that a lot of people stopped talking about it, stopped worrying about it, all of those things. But in fact, it's really far from over. So break it down for us, if you would.
Sure. So the minimum wage ordinance passed on December 2nd, 2014. So about 3 years ago, exactly 3 years ago. And it gradually raises the wage to $13 an hour by 2019, but it's still a work in progress. So the city considers nearly 100 professions, including barbers, nail technicians, private security firms, to be exempt from the minimum wage ordinance because they're regulated by the state. So that means that those businesses only have to pay workers the state minimum wage, which is $8.25 an hour, instead of the city's, which is $11 an hour. And this is news to the state. So, there have been some issues. Some people have been filing lawsuits because they're not being paid the minimum wage. And until now, we're starting to understand why that's happening. But, I think it's all about enforcement, too. The city says that they've been interpreting the ordinance that way since the beginning. But as a result, a lot of those complaints that have been filed against the city haven't led to investigations.
So, and why do we think that is so far?
Why they haven't led to investigations?
Right.
Well, the problem is that some people who make complaints with the city don't follow up with the necessary paperwork to trigger an investigation. Some people don't file complaints at all because they're too scared. They're afraid that they're going to lose their jobs and they can't afford to do that. And another thing is, the Business Affairs and Consumer Protection Department, they only have 4 investigators assigned to investigate minimum wage complaints, which is up from 2 last year. But, a lot of people are experts and activists are saying that they really need more resources to do more work, right?
Right. As you note in the piece that appears at ChicagoTribune.com, almost 550 complaints about minimum wage violations have been filed with the Department of Business Affairs and Consumer Protection, and only 140 of them or so have been processed. That number, to ask 4 people to do that work, that's quite a bit. So it's really, there's some logistics issues here at play. But also, I think it is important to as you noted, to talk a bit about workers fearing retaliation, because that's who else is going to report it? I mean, it's almost has to come from the workers.
Exactly. And, there are so many different reasons why people wouldn't want to come forward. I talked to a lot of people who wouldn't come forward because of their immigration status, for example. They don't understand, or they don't believe that there are laws in place to protect them, but there are. So
right. And so what is the next step here? So now that we are having this conversation, now that this is a subject that the state and city levels acknowledge as an issue, what are the next steps and what is going to be done to remedy this?
So the city says that they're, for the first 2 years, they were focused more on educating businesses about the ordinance, but that beginning this year, that approach has shifted to a more aggressive enforcement. I think they've recovered about $213,000 in lost wages for underpaid workers, but they still haven't issued fines for the companies who are being found guilty of that. And so that could change, but experts say that they need to create a unit maybe that could focus solely on those minimum wage complaints, so that you know, they're less dependent on complaints coming to them and more proactive in seeking out non-compliant businesses.
Right, right, certainly. But it is an interesting, the story, you're calling it a loophole, which I think is completely fair, but it seems like a really dangerous and slippery slope that some businesses are classified in such a different way just because of state licensing and things like that, that mm-hmm. it seems like there's work, speaking of proactive, it seems like there's also work that needs to be done in the way different professions are classified.
Right. And it was news to the city news to the state, but the city says that, you know, that's how they've been interpreting it all along. It's certainly news to us, but, you know, I'm not sure what is going to be done now to address that.
Right. Well, we will keep turning to you at ChicagoTribune.com as this continues to develop, because it is a really, really interesting story. And when you start looking into the nearly 100 professions that are not considered or that are considered exempt here, that are not considered falling under this minimum wage ordinance, it really is quite interesting. And it gives you a very different perspective of the city as you're just kind of going about your day of who might be making what and who's paid fairly and who is not. So thank you so much for joining us and breaking all this down for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. Always grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the program. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about how office holiday parties are changing right now, given the climate of a lot of workplaces and a lot of topics that are up in many workplace discussions. So we're going to be talking about that here in just a bit. But right now we're joined by Peter Coy, who is the economics editor and a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote about how we may begin to police tech giants in the future and whether or not our current laws are really up to the task. Peter, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy.
Well, this is a really, I don't think I've gotten through a single show in probably 2 years without talking about this very topic. So I'm very excited to talk to you about this, because it seems like we're constantly hearing of situations in which the technology or user habits are just slightly ahead of the law, and it's a matter of the law catching up. So,
So
talk us through where we're at right now.
Well, I talk about four companies: Apple, Google, which of course is part of Alphabet, Amazon, and Facebook. And the conundrum is that these companies make some of the world's best-loved products and services. They're also loved by investors. I mean, we're talking about four of the five most valuable companies on the planet, the only other one in the top five being Microsoft, which could almost put in the same camp. And yet, on the other hand, they're accused of various sins, crushing competition, avoiding taxes, actions against democracy, privacy. And so what do you do? You know, you don't want these companies to go away. We need them. We love them. And we have a love-hate relationship, I guess you could say.
Yeah, very true. And in the piece that's on Bloomberg that you wrote, it really breaks it down kind of by company and some of the big things. But you mentioned privacy, and I think that one touches several of these companies. So I want to kind of start with that issue. And where are the biggest privacy concerns with each of these companies right now, legally speaking?
Well, privacy is comes up probably a lot with Facebook, for example. You can find issues with any one of the four, but think of what we do with Facebook. We put our lives out there for everybody to see, and it's the kind of thing we never used to do. I mean, so part of it, it seems as though people have voluntarily surrendered their privacy. And yet they're also kind of not quite happy when the companies like Facebook vacuum up all the data they collect about you and use it to market products to you, to form a profile of you. There are, in a way, the cloud knows more about you in some ways than you know about yourself. And so the question is, again, what do you do about it? Try to fight the tide of the way tech is going and kind of crack down? Or do you just say, this is the new world we live in?
Right, right. There is a really fascinating book called Terms of Service that really talks about a lot of this. And that book mentions how it's kind of a hitting us twice, because on one level, it's what we're sharing gets, as I loved how you put that, vacuumed up into a single profile of us as users. But then there's also the other piece of that is what's done with it. And then there's kind of the actions we take, like, did this user who we know this much about this person, did they then click on this? What is their behavior online? And how that kind of, there's sort of this secondary beat of data we don't even necessarily know we're generating. And I think that part, that is to me a very big concern, and I think should be bigger, particularly when we're talking about Google search results. If different people are receiving different results, to me, that's a very, very big problem.
Did you hear about this case a few years ago where some company, I think a diapers company, started sending coupons to the 16-year-old girl, and her father was outraged. He said, how could you send this? This is my 16-year-old daughter. She's not even pregnant. And then he had to apologize a few weeks later when it turned out that she was pregnant, and the company had sort of figured it out from her social media stuff.
Wow.
What website she was looking at.
How interesting. That is interesting, right? And I run into that a lot. I'm sure you do too, as we are researching topics and writing about things and then posting, here's what I just wrote, here's what I just did. Suddenly our ads get targeted in very interesting ways indeed. So let's shift a little bit to Apple, because I feel like they, of the big three, we tend to talk the most about platforms more,
right,
a little more than we do about products. So let's kind of shift to Apple, and where is the law really, where are the big concerns around Apple?
Apple was hard to leave out of the story just because it's the most valuable company in the world and it is a tech company. But as you said, it's not a platform in the way that Amazon, Facebook, and Google are so much. It's more, it sells products and sells them very well, as well as, of course, the music store and so on. So with them, I focused on the question of taxes. Because as you know, they have, at the end of the last fiscal year, they had $216 billion in cash and marketable securities held by subsidiaries outside the U.S. And why are they doing that? Because they don't want to pay U.S. tax on them. And the law says that you don't have to pay the tax until you bring the money home. So, of course, we all know that the Congress is in the middle of passing a new tax law, and both houses have provisions in it that the foreign-held money would be taxed, even if they don't bring it home, but at a preferential rate. So instead of paying 35%, they would pay down in the single digits or teens, depending on which kind of money and which house we're talking about. So I have a question. I mean, Amy, what do you think? Do you think that they should pay the full 35%, or should they get some kind of a break? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, you certainly are closer to this topic than I, hence we've brought you onto the show to talk about it. But no, I think this is something we have addressed on the program before, and in particular about startups that are helping businesses to use more overseas resources to pay fewer taxes. And it seems very maddening to the individual when, you know, so many people are like, well, but think of what I could, if I didn't have to pay my own taxes, think of what I could save, or if I had that kind of deal.
So the deal with these companies is they're kind of playing chicken with the government.
Right.
They're saying, we're not going to bring our money home until you give us a tax break. And they gave them a tax break in the last decade, and they did bring a bunch of money home, and it did not go into building new factories and hiring new people as they had said it would. And they immediately started doing it again as soon as the tax break ended. And the government vowed, no, we're not going to keep doing this. We're not going to keep getting suckered and giving you tax breaks for bringing money home. But it's exactly what's happening all over again.
Right. It is this like endless circular debate for sure. Well, and to me, I'm very fascinated by how differently some of these, if we kind of shift back to privacy a bit, how differently some of these play out in European courtrooms versus U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's really fascinating. To me, that tells a lot about the political engagement and the role culturally and politically of tech giants here versus in Europe, which is really, to me, something very interesting to watch. You know, Facebook really got hit pretty hard by a European court just in the last, I'd say, 18 months or so. So all very interesting things to watch. But if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this story out because it is really
fascinating.
Excellent.
Thanks.
And digs into all this, because I want everyone to read this story, because it really digs in kind of company by company of really how there is a lot going on behind the scenes with all of them. And it really behooves us to hold these major companies accountable. So thank you so much, Peter Coy, for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, back in just a bit, to talk about how office holiday parties are shifting a little bit this year in response to the wave of harassment and assault allegations around the country. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Another fine song. Love that song so much. Tis the season, my friends. 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. You know, this time of year, a lot of companies are throwing holiday parties, and they have for years and years, and that's what happens. But right now, it's a little bit different year, I think we can all agree, because in light of many, many recent allegations of harassment and assault around the country in a lot of different industries, a lot of companies are changing the way they are approaching the holiday party. And so here joining us to talk about that is from the Chicago Tribune upstairs, Samantha Baumkamp. Thanks for being with us today. Always lovely to have you on the show.
Oh, so great to be here. Thanks, Amy.
So how are companies shifting in response to that? I've seen a couple of companies tweeting things about how they're going to limit alcohol. I know Vox Media put a big piece out there, about how, or they didn't put out, but it was written about them, rather, after a memo came from the CEO about, hey, you know, we're going to do this differently this year. There's, instead of an open bar, we're going to have 2 drink coupons, and then you can switch to Pepsi. The end. nothing right. Harder than a Coke. So what are you seeing from other companies?
Well, it's interesting because the alcohol, I think, is the biggest piece of the puzzle. They don't want, otherwise reasonable people getting a little too crazy and having something happen that they regret. We also saw it seems like more companies are shifting to an earlier time or even a lunch party or a Saturday morning or something to that effect to limit the alcohol that way, to discourage alcohol consumption by making it earlier in the day so people aren't as prone to party so hard. Mm-hmm. And then we're seeing some companies cancel. But, of course, that can backfire in the sphere of public opinion as well. So
sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting when this started to emerge and we start hearing about companies doing this, even anecdotally and on social media and whatnot. You know, I think there was a lot of it seems like there's kind of a couple different narratives here. One of them is great. That's a great idea for companies to be proactive. The other one is, well, but you know, if your culture is bad, if you already have a toxic culture in which this kind of thing is happening, really is eliminating alcohol just kind of putting a Band-Aid on maybe a bigger cultural problem?
Exactly. And that's a lot of what we found. It's not only worrying about the perception of canceling an office party at this point, saying, you know, what was the problem in the culture before, but it may be a sign that the company just plain didn't have enough checks and balances in place to stop sexual harassment in the first place. And as one person, a Northwestern professor that I interviewed in the story noted, you know, it's not what we're seeing in the public now, Harvey Weinstein, you know, and on all these that came after him, is that it's not at the holiday office party that this the one and only time that these women are being assaulted or harassed. It's happening at the water cooler. It's happening over text message, and it's happening every single day. So it's really a matter of getting these strict rules in place to prevent it in the first place, and then fixing the culture, quite frankly, to both in the company and then broadly, to make sure that this is, you know, stopped from before it even begins.
Right, right. I mean, I think as we've heard all of these stories about, these times of harassment and assault that have happened in industries around, a range of industries, it seems like it it sometimes is the big overt gesture, but sometimes it's also smaller things over a period of time that really add up. And I think even in non-assault cases, but minor infractions of discrimination and things like that, it's that the kind of death by a thousand cuts thing that we hear about a lot.
Right. Absolutely. These companies have really got to be vigilant all along the way. And if I know, you know, a lot of people would say that if you're cutting out the office party, in the era we're in now, where we're seeing all these allegations come to light, then you're way too late in the ball game and you already have a problem. So it's a really interesting dilemma.
Right, right. I mean, it is an interesting one. And I think it'll be interesting to continue to watch how companies kind of shift. I'm very interested in kind of those, you hear about companies with kind of the golden handcuffs kind of perks that are, you know, for a while we were talking about if a company would kind of Googleize the office and they would put like a ping pong table or something that encouraged, play and interaction to ostensibly stimulate creativity. I wonder about that kind of like non-work time that's in the workplace too, because that seems like a time when you're socializing.
I know. And that's a huge issue as well. And actually, interestingly, another part of that sort of Googleizing as the office, as you put it so well, is that we've seen studies that millennials and younger workers don't feel the need to have a big Christmas party, blowout festivities with the boss anymore. They want to stay at the office because the office has a ping pong table. The office has an Xbox, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the office is so much more to us these days than just work. It's where we spend, you know, at least a third of our lives. And the better it gets, the less I think workers see the value in these big lavish parties. And that's another thing that we're seeing, you know, not just sexual harassment fears, but also just a shift to more subdued celebrations.
Right. In your reporting on this story, did you get the sense that there were companies who had perhaps made an adjustment to their plans for holiday parties, but not changed policy in the workplace in the day to day?
You know, we didn't hear a whole lot of that, and that's unfortunate. But we did hear the flip side. You know, one of the greatest examples that I saw was LaSalle Network, and they are actually one of the biggest holiday parties that we see in Chicago at the end of the year. They invite, you know, almost 1,000 people to their shindig and have it in an outside event space or a restaurant. Their CEO just told me plainly, you know, while we are absolutely vigilant about what happens and anything that would go wrong and as far as sexual harassment in the workplace, we never considered not having this party because holiday celebrations are frankly one of the few major perks that a lot of employees have left. And he just didn't want to take that away from the majority of employees that are good and professional all the time.
Right, which is a perfectly valid point, right? That
right.
It's kind of like punishing everybody because there's a few people that are wrecking the culture rather than just adjusting the culture and the workplace environment. Yeah, it is a really interesting one. And so I was really interested to read this piece, and I'll be sure and tweet it out later so that everyone gets a chance to read this about how the office holiday party is shifting a little bit. So on this note, what do you think, you know, as we go into the new year, you know, this seems like an immediate response to a story that's still developing and still ongoing. What do you think will be happening in the new year? Will we see more companies adjusting their policy or making even more dramatic changes to try to fix workplace culture where it perhaps isn't healthy?
I think there has to be a reckoning on behalf of companies to really look down and see whether policies on paper are translating into the culture and translating into real difference for women and men in the workplace and make it a more comfortable environment. Because the reality is that there have been dozens and dozens of companies that have been called out by the EEOC or other regulatory bodies and been found to have a prevalence of sexual harassment in their workplaces, and yet they had, you know, they felt like they had plenty of policy to stop it. And so I think that whether it will be public or not is still in question. But I think a lot of companies have to be looking at this right now and seeing how they can do better, even in the smallest ways.
Indeed, indeed. I think you're right that we will see kind of a reckoning in the year ahead, because you can have policies all day, but if there aren't consequences that are actually enforced, not much can happen, right? So
exactly.
It will be very interesting. Well, thank you so much, Samantha Baumkamp, for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. So everybody,
my pleasure.
Continue, follow her on social media and continue to see all of her great work at chicagotribune.com. All right, we're going to take a break, get you the news, all that good stuff. And then I'm going to turn things over to Scott Catoon for the Startup Showcase. He's got a big show planned for you back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.